You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Our pleasure. I'm doing well. Nice to have you. I've actually had you in this office before, but I'm very happy to have you
remotely. I've been in your office, in your lavish home office. Yes. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero newsletter. This is a Non-Zero podcast. You are Bruce Feiler, very well-known and prolific author. You wrote, for example, the ultra-mega bestseller, Walking the Bible, and you've written other bestsellers. A few years ago, you wrote a book called Life is in the Transitions, Mastering Change at Any Age. And we actually had a podcast conversation about that. And as we will discover, that is not entirely unrelated to your latest book, just out, A Time to Gather, How Ritual Created the World and How It Can Save Us. Now, Bruce, saving us sounds like a tall order. But if there was one person I would trust to chart the path to our salvation, and I was not available for whatever reason, I might well choose you. I might.
That's very kind of you. But are you going to raise your hand and say that you actually vehemently endorsed this subtitle that now you're cracking jokes about?
No. I kid because I love this subtitle. How Ritual Created the World and How It Can Save Us. Look,
there you go.
You've seen some of my titles and subtitles. Yes. I don't make fun of people for grandiose titles and subtitles. Glass houses, man. No, it's fine. It's great. So what I want you to do is unpack it a little. Of course, there's a lot there. I mean, ritual is a fascinating phenomenon to begin with. And I think you can explain various reasons you think we could use a renaissance in rituals and various reasons, various signs you say that it's happening. I would just add quickly that artificial intelligence, the subject of my own next book, is another reason to think we're going to need more of the kind of systematic human contact that rituals provide. But I'll just throw that. We can tend to that later.
I'm looking forward to tending to that later because I absolutely agree with you. Well, let me go. Let me start this way. So since we're going to talk about the ancient world a little bit, like I belong to the tribe of group keepers, right? Like I'm the runner of the family, you know, dinner game, right? I lead the family meeting. I organize the backyard Olympics. I collect the family stories. Every family has one, frankly, more than one. Every team has one, every group. I'm like, I'm the group keeper, mm-hmm. you know, in my life. And so I'm sort of wired in this way. And then, so what happened to me is that I stumbled into a kind of crisis of the group, right? And so what happened was my dad died, my mom is aging, and 21 years ago, last week, as you and I taped this conversation, my wife Linda and I went from empty nest to full nest in 32 minutes mm-hmm. when we became the parents of identical twin daughters. 18 years later, we went from full nest to empty nest in 32 minutes when we dropped them off at different ends of the same university campus. And we drove back to Brooklyn, where I'm sitting right now, and I walked in the door of my own home and I felt very precisely homesick in my own home. And my initial reaction was, don't tell anybody this feeling. Like, that is not a socially acceptable feeling, right? That's what adolescents are feeling when they go to sleepaway camp or they go to a sleepover at a friend's. And then I thought, oh, well, again, I understand now because all the relationships in my life were in a state of flux and I wasn't alone. Everyone I know was going through changes of some kind or Googling strange diseases or looking at feeling sort of digital saturation. But you mentioned very kindly in the intro, I think the last time I was on this podcast, was that I've spent a fair bit of the last 10 years thinking about how we navigate change. Mm-hmm. I have collected and analyzed 500 life stories of Americans in all walks of life, all 50 states. And I thought I was ready for this moment. I call them life quakes, as you know, like life quakes is the underlying eruption in your life. And then the transition is the human response to that. And we can, you know, dig into that or not, depending on where this conversation goes. So I thought, oh, I know what I need. I need a ritual. Like, I need a way to remake the group. And that is when I basically tripped headfirst into what I now think of as the most interesting paradox that I've encountered in maybe 40 years of writing books professionally, but certainly the last 25 years. And the basic, you know, shape of it is the following. Rituals are one of the few things we know that work. Okay? It is they are the elemental human act. We have 300,000 years of evidence that humans gathered to mark changes. Okay? 300,000 years. I don't have to tell you this, but that's longer than we've been anatomical humans. We have evidence of in these caves all over, not one or two, like all over, like, you know, art galleries all over the world inside these caves with evidence that humans and early humans and prehumans gathered to bury their dead. So we think of this story that kind of ritual created, we think of the story that religion created ritual. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the default, especially for those you and me who are inclined to think seriously evolutionarily about religion. But in fact, it's the other way around. Ritual preceded religion by hundreds of thousands of years. And in fact, it was this telling of the story of why are we doing this that in many ways created organized religion. Okay. So here's the frame, right? So the first piece of this paradox is that ritual works for hundreds, thousands of centuries. Wherever we've looked in any culture, people use rituals when there's instability in the group, right? Someone comes in the group like a birth or a wedding. Someone leaves the group like a coming of age or a funeral. When someone gets sick or moves, the community holds a ritual to reconstitute and remake itself until this century when we've turned our backs on them. Mm-hmm. No one's having birth rituals. No one's having coming of age rituals. Okay. In 1960, 90%, 96% of eligible American adults got married in the course of their lives. Now fewer than 50% of us are married, as you know. And again, this was news to me. We're not even holding funerals anymore because in 1970.
Yeah, that surprised me. I mean, it didn't. I mean, for one thing, there are fewer burials, right? And more cremations, right? For starters.
5% of Americans were cremated in 1970. Now it's 65%, going mm-hmm. to 80% in the next 10 years. And only one in five has a burial of cremains, and only, you know, one in four holds a ceremony of any kind. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is the thing that we know works, and we've abandoned them. And yet, as you teed up in the beginning, at the same time, there's all these new rituals popping up around the world, you know, in effect, to kind of replace the ones that we're turning our backs on them. Okay. Some of these are silly, like promposals and gender reveals. Some of them are just renamings, like, you know, commitment ceremonies instead of weddings or celebrations of life instead of funerals. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them are things, here we go, that organized religion never honored. Not just marriage, but divorce. Not just birth, but stillbirth, right? Not just, you know, not just first menstruation, but yeah, you know, end of the arrival of menopause. Like all of these things, because this is the human response to the sense of pain and confusion we feel in times of change. And the last thing I'll say, and then you can take this because there's seven directions we could go. The essence of it is that the top-down, institutionally mandated, prescripted, pre-approved life rituals that institutions in effect foisted on us are being replaced by bottom-up, bespoke, individually created, I'm going through a difficult time, I'm having a mastectomy, and I want my friends around, even if my institution never honored that. That's the essence of the big change. And I was like, I'm a little shamefaced I didn't know this, but I got to figure out what's going on.
Now, are all of these what you call shadow rituals or anything that's kind of improvised outside of a traditional ritual sponsoring institution or?
Well, I think a lot of them are shadow. For example, a divorce is a perfect example, a stillbirth. I mean, this is an astonishing story. Mm-hmm. I mean, Linda, my wife, her favorite chapter is the Taylor Swift divorce party, right? Because there's a woman in Long Island who I tracked down, incredible story. Her parents were divorced. Both of her grandparents were divorced. This is never going to happen to me, she said. What happens? She gets married, has two kids. She gets divorced. Husband takes half the stuff. The rest she puts on the dining room table, and she and her sister give it away. And she walks in and she said, you know what I need right now? I need a wedding registry. Mm-hmm. I need a divorce. So she creates the world's first divorce registry. because she needs toothpaste, you know, toothbrush holders and sheets and towels. And then she realized that's not enough. She's going to create a ritual. And she kind of posts a semi-humorous blog post about a Taylor Swift divorce party with Shake It Off cupcakes and We Are Never, Ever, Ever Getting Back Together banners. And mm-hmm. it like goes crazy because all these, and I'm like, what's going on here? And she's like, well, everyone experienced this in shame. And millennials grew up, went online and started talking and realized other people are feeling this and there's no reason to feel ashamed. She's like, I can feel upset that I'm, you know, that my marriage failed, but not feel like a failure for the rest of my life. So that's a classic, what I call shadow ritual, mm-hmm. because the institutions never honored it. Other ones are ones that they never thought to do, like a gotcha day ceremony for somebody who was adopted, cancerversaries, soberversaries, NICU graduations.
I have to ask, do you celebrate cancerversaries? One thing we have in common is we've had cancer. Yours was a more harrowing version than mine, but
the answer is yes. I'm aware of it.
Yeah.
And let's remember because when I got cancer, for those of you who don't know, when I got an adult onset pediatric cancer when I was 43 and my identical twins were 3, what's the thing that I instantly did 2 days later was I created this group of men to be around and I called mm-hmm. them the Council of Dads. Now mm-hmm. in the context, I now see that as a kind of ritual gathering.
Well, it was. And that became a book and actually a TV series, didn't it?
It became a TV series on NBC. So to your point, not only are we both cancer survivors, I will say this, you were very supportive of me, came to see me when I had just gotten out of the hospital. And I believe in a small way that I was able to...
You gave me valuable guidance when I had
be a companion when you were going through it. Mm-hmm. That's the urge. That's the same thing. In these difficult times, we want to connect. Let me just take a second here, because this is you and this is, you know, your community. What is a ritual?
I was going to ask you that question. I hope you're about to answer it.
Okay, would you like to ask me that question so I don't take...
What is a ritual, Bruce?
That's such a great question. I would never have thought to bring it, but I think it's worth discussing. Because among other things, the history of it is very interesting because it gets really deep into the history of academia, when the ritual studies began to emerge in the 19th century, exactly at the time, by the way, mm-hmm. when Western society began to decouple from organized religion. That's when the study of ritual emerged. That is not a coincidence, okay? Mm-hmm. This is a story that you've been, in many ways, far deeper immersed in than me. So what is a ritual? First of all, there are different kinds of rituals. So there are political rituals, like inaugurations and coronations. There's calendric rituals, May Day, you know, Midsummer, Thanksgiving. There are daily rituals, like handshaking or bowing or namaste or whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. And then there are what I call life rituals, which honor these kind of periodic moments of change that you go through. So a ritual is a shared, unnecessary act that makes us feel at home. So let's just take a second and break that. It's an act because it's a doing, it's not a talking. Shared because it connects us, and there are, you know, hundreds of studies that show what actually happens in us biologically, neuroscientific, you know, in our brains, in our bodies, in our heart rates, etc. Unnecessary, this was a surprise to me, but unnecessary because you don't have to get down on one knee to get engaged. You don't have to wear black to mourn. You don't have to circle the bride 7 times to get married. But these are sort of unnecessities that we add to these acts that become necessities, right? So, you know, washing your hands is, to take an example I just said, washing your hands is utilitarian. You're getting the germs off. You're preparing to eat. Handshaking has no utilitarian purpose. It's just a symbolic act that says, I'm not carrying a weapon and we can form relationship, right? The dinner bell is utilitarian. The chemo bell, another new ritual, not in place when I had cancer 18 years ago. Everybody gathers to ring it. That's a ritual. And then the last thing is, the thing that I'm most in some ways passionate about, that I think is sort of a contribution that I'm making to this conversation, is that it makes us feel at home. And that gets to the sort of existential homesickness that I think is a huge problem right now. And the ritual creates a kind of replicable, portable sense of home that you can recreate lots of places other than home. But it's the response to the homesickness that we all feel.
Mm-hmm. So I guess more than one thing has happened that has led to the demise of many traditional rituals. One is declining commitment to certain kinds of institutional structures, including religion. But another thing you talk about is a change in the, the extent to which, I don't know what exact terminology you use, but the extent to which culture is group oriented as opposed to individually oriented. Now, you may not be old enough to actually remember when the talk of the town was Christopher Lash's book, The Culture of Narcissism.
Yes.
Tom Wolfe wrote this thing, The Me Decade.
Yes.
But that's when I first remember hearing about this. Is that kind of the beginning of what you see this ritual renaissance, which we're going to put some more flesh on eventually, being a response to?
Well, I would say it's definitely a part. I'm not quite sure I would say the beginning. I think I would probably put the beginning a little bit earlier. Once you have the permission to not be bound by institutional mandates,
mm-hmm.
that permission granting structure is a very big part of this. I mean, one of the ways that I understand religion, and when you look at the sociology, is if you went back 100 years and everybody had to join the institution in the town, because if you wanted to have friends, if you wanted to have commerce, if you wanted to get married, you need it. And probably a lot of people were joining who didn't necessarily believe it.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you got permission to break away, and apologies if you're hearing Brooklyn horn noise behind me. But once you have permission to go away, that creates an opening. Yeah. Number two, yes, we basically accelerate the focus on self-care, self-worth, self-esteem. Mm-hmm. I mean, my editor took it out, but I had this line in there. I looked at the hashtags on Instagram, and like self-care had like 27 million and group care had about 270, right? And it was like, we don't even have a language for this group keeping that I'm talking about. We've gotten so, but social media is not a small part either. Okay.
Right.
Because social media, there's the performative nature of many of these rituals. So if you're having a wedding, if you're having a baby, if you're having a double mastectomy, whatever it might be, soberversary, a cancerversary, as we just, jokingly did in passing, there's a kind of sense that you perform it. But even more, there's a sense that you see what everybody else is doing that you didn't have access to before.
Mm.
I mean, we didn't mention this, so I'll just say it quickly. What I did when I went into this topic was I spent 3 years. I participated in life rituals in 16 countries on 6 continents. I tracked down 100 of the top ritual designers on the planet, interviewed with them, coded their stories, created what I think is probably the first of its kind database of different things you can do to try to come up with a blueprint for how to have one of these if you want to make one up. But one of those things was I went to 6 weddings in a day in Las Vegas. And I talked to this woman, and she was talking about the popularity of unity rituals in weddings. Okay. So you and I, and the most popular one is a sand ceremony. So you and I are getting married. You have we did this. I am old enough that we did it in kindergarten when I was a kid. You have a vial of blue sand, and I have a vial of pink sand, and we alternate them in a third vial, and we create. And so she says she has one of her rules is, if you say thingy, I'm not doing it. So when couples come to her, this woman, her name is Angie Kelly. She runs Peachy Keen Unions. She does thousands of weddings a year. And people come and say, I want to do the sand ceremony thingy. Then she says, no. What do you actually want? How did you meet? So she tells me the story, as you saw in my book, where, how did we meet? Oh, it turns out you sent me an apple brandy in the Seattle airport. So let's do a unity ceremony that's apple brandy. One, you have one kind of apple brandy. I have another. We'll pour them and we'll drink it. Mm-hmm. So this happens to me in, it was November, actually, when I was on my 6 weddings in a day in Las Vegas with Elvis, the whole thing. 4 months later, I'm in the Andes Mountains, forest bathing, and talking to Mapuche healers. And I'm talking to a guy who is an Anglo guy who lives in Santiago. And he says, I'm getting married. And the only thing that my bride insisted on is a sand ceremony. Like, so how does that happen? The answer is that happens because of Pinterest and Instagram sharing all these things, which is why one of my things that you need in your ritual is a peace plan. Something old, something new, something borrowed, something new. Like, it's okay to borrow. But social media plays a part.
Now, you're going to have to quickly tell us what forest bathing is, I'm afraid.
So forest bathing is one of the fastest growing ritual subcultures in the world. As you know, but most people listening to us probably don't. I lived in Japan in the 1980s.
Wrote a book called Learning to Bow. That was your first book.
That was my first book. 38 years ago, as I sit here and talk to you. And in the 1980s, that was kind of peak salaryman culture in Japan. And Japan, as you probably know, is mostly forested. It's like 80% uninhabitable. So you got 150 million people living in an area the size of South Carolina, because 80% of it's covered in mountains and forests. So, and people were in these tight, you know, cramped offices. They were working six and a half days a week in those days. And so the forest ministry says, we got to get people out. And so they invent this thing called Shinrin-yoku, which the three characters mean basically bathe and interconnectedness in the woods. And the name that sticks is forest bathing. You can now do it in 70 countries, from the Himalayas to the Rift Valley to the Black Forest in Germany. And it is a group activity where you go together into nature and you have guided experiences where you, connect, experience, notice things in nature, and then share with the group. So 6 months after that, I was in Boston writing about the modern mikveh movement, which is cold plunging in water. Mm-hmm. And so lots of water rituals around the world, including in the manosphere, interestingly enough. And I meet this woman who's a forest bathing instructor, and she says, I spend a lot of time in the forest by myself. I take my dog on walks. That's not forest bathing. The essence of it is the communal experience. And this is sort of the theme that we're talking about. So the point I'm trying to make is these things are popping up all over simultaneously, because the essential things that rituals do for us is calm us down, connect us with others, and have a whole series of ameliorative positive effects based around the fact that in the moments that we're most in pain and confused and unsure what to do, we don't go into a fetal position under the covers. We join with other people. That's the essence of the ritual experience.
Mm-hmm. And is a group always explicitly or implicitly involved? I was trying to think of examples where they're not, but somebody might meditate every day, and they might, and of course, meditation, you might not call a ritual because it has utility, but they might bow to a Buddha statue beforehand. They're alone. On the other hand, to bow to that statue is to emphasize your connection to a whole tradition involving a whole group and so on. So group is part of the kind of definition?
To me, it's part of the definition, okay? And I'll say two things about this, and I'll do it quickly. Yes, I think if you're meditating to get a higher test score so you can get into an elite college, that to me does not count as a ritual. It's a habit. It's motivation. It's a lot of things. But to me, that's not. If you are meditating to connect with the world around you for peace on earth, to, as you said, replicate some things other people do, that qualifies as ritual. So to me, I think that the group is. So to me, I think the group is essential to the process. And that's what I felt at the beginning of the process. I will say the biggest change that I went through in the course of this is because I'm me, and like you, I like geeking out on the science and the history and how this thing all came about in the 19th century with Durkheim versus Van Gennep. It's a very interesting story. And so when Arnold Van Gennep comes up with the idea in 1909 of a rite of passage, and he invents the term, and he says there are the big four, birth, coming of age, marriage, death, that stays the same for 100 years, and that no longer works. Not only are we living longer, but our lives are much more unvariable and are not following pre-approved linear constructs that you see in a textbook. So where I end up in this project, back to the saving the world idea, is whenever you have the opportunity, you should lurch at it. I learned this from my kids. Okay. Like if they're home, I can't say, sorry, we can't have a ritual because it's not in a, you know, it's not on the list that was made in 1909 in Paris. I'm going to like, we're here now. Let's do something. So mm-hmm. we need to move from this idea that we can only have them every 3, 4, 5 years to we have opportunities all the time. And we need to create what I call a ritual state of mind because the enemy's in our pockets and the enemy's coming at us all the time. And we have to respond much more quickly. So we have to move in my framing here from rites of passage to bites of passage and like take a nibble whenever you can.
Hmm. So the enemy's in our pocket, referring to the smartphone, presumably.
Correct.
And so elaborate on that. In the context of salvation, in other words, kind of what is in danger of happening to us if we don't continue to embrace ritual more fully in creative ways that make sense for the current era?
Okay, well, here's how I see it very, very simply. Ritual is the original human algorithm. Right? It is the mechanism by which we cohere. Okay? So now our algorithms that we've outsourced to the tech gods, including many people that you are writing about in your new book, those are algorithms designed to divide. We all know this. The data is undeniable. I quote this study in my book about they would set up, these researchers would set up dummy accounts as adolescent males, and within 9 minutes, they were getting negative things, misogynist, divisive, violent contact. Within 30 minutes, 96% of what was in their feed, an account that was just set up, is divisive. So we know those algorithms are divide. And the only thing strong enough, and I will be as grandiose as my subtitle permits. The only thing strong enough to hold us together in a world where everything is pulling us apart is ritual. And because it is gathering, it is connecting, it is celebrating, it is mourning, it is becoming, it is loving, it is all the essential acts. One of the things I tried to do in my book is rebrand the big four from birth, coming of age, marriage, death, first of all, okay, to welcoming, becoming, loving, and mourning, because every ritual has every other ritual. And again, I learned this from my kids. When we were like, we did this ritual before we took them to college 3 years ago, they were much more upset about the end of their childhood than they were by the beginning of their young adulthood. Mm. And in a way, we were too. I bet we were, you know, yeah. mourning the end of the kind of day-to-day parenting more than, so every ritual contains, if you're getting married, you're saying goodbye to the single years or you're having a baby. We all know mm-hmm. what that means, right? And trust me, I had two in 32 minutes. Like, so every ritual contains every other ritual. And then there's this new ritual, which I call renewing, which we're doing constantly in the course of our lives. There's the life breaks and the life transitions. And so what I'm saying is, whatever the problem is, one of these rituals is the answer. If it's loneliness and isolation, ritual is the answer. If it's political polarization, ritual is the answer. And yes, Professor, if it's AI, a ritual is the answer, because that's the essence of being human, that we renew when we're together. And that's the only thing strong enough to push back against the LLMs and everything else that's coming.
Okay. Now, there is a flip side to ritual, which is that it can be part of the problem yes. that you're hoping it will solve. You mentioned political polarization. Well, two highly polarized tribes yes. can have rituals that keep them polarized and sustain their own worldview, complete with the kinds of cognitive biases that keep them from understanding the other group's motivations and actual worldview and grievances and so on, right?
There's great data on this, and there's no doubt that's correct. Why? Because ritual works, right? So if you're uh-huh. in a gang, you know, if you're in a terrorist group, you know, if you're forget the tribes, which naturally have antipathy, as we all know, to the out-group. Groups that are trying to quickly cohere into criminality or terrorism or hooliganism in the case of sports, yes, they also do all of the tribal things. So exactly. I want to be very clear. Ritual is not perfect. You know, it's not the best answer, but I do believe quite strongly that it's the best answer we have. Mm-hmm.
And then there are rituals about which reasonable people might disagree. In other words, some might be cynical, some might not. I thought of this with the is the term dignified transfer. Remember this recent case where, okay, so it was a fallen soldier and the body was being transferred at an airport, I guess. And a dignified transfer is a ceremony. I don't know how long it's been around, where some official, you know, I don't know, some military officers and sometimes some official, in this case, including President Trump, who caught some flack for wearing a red baseball cap during the ceremony. But I thought, I mean, you know, my ideology on foreign policy, I thought one might see this kind of thing as a way to provide positive reinforcement to basically working class families who offer their sons and daughters to imperil themselves and sometimes lose their lives for the sake of causes that I don't always endorse, and in the course of wars that I sometimes think are illegal and stupid. You know, you get the picture. Yes. You can be, and yet, look, there are wars that I thought were justified. And moreover, I see value in, like, once this has happened, providing some consolation for the parents. I understand that. So there's a whole, you know, there's a range of rituals.
I mean, a perfect example to that leads to actually the best single ritual story that I have. And so I'll take a second and tell it. But another perfect example of this thing, which is beautiful, ritualistic, and powerful.
Are you going to mention the honor walk?
Well, I'm about to mention the honor walk. But before I mention the honor walk, I'm going to mention what inspired it, which was the blue line when a police officer is killed in the line of duty. Those very powerful rituals. Think back to 9/11. You and I are old enough again to have those for all the firefighters who went down in the tower, the towers. Incredible, powerful rituals, and that was one of those a blue line funerals that inspired the best single story that I know. And it begins in a small town in Ohio. Missy Holiday. Church family. Her father's the mayor and fire chief. Her mother teaches Presbyterian church. She grows up, becomes a nurse, moves to Indianapolis. She comes home Super Bowl weekend in the early 90s, and her sister whispers in her ear that she's going to get engaged next week. There's a little sisterly bond. Sister gets in the car. It had snowed the night before. She skids, and her car wraps around a tree. Two brain tests that night. And then at 6 a.m, a doctor comes in and says, she's an organ donor. We're taking her away, rips her from the family. And Missy is devastated. And she says, I'm never going to let this happen to anybody again. She quits her job. She enters the donor support world for organ donation. And she discovers incredible tension between and among the three constituents. That's the families. That's the doctor, the medical staff. And that's the donor support groups. And then one day she watches on TV a funeral of a police officer. And she said, that's what my family needed. And she invents this ritual where they put the body. Again, I hadn't really thought about this. Like, you know, to get the organs, you got to go back to the OR. So you're in the ICU. Mm-hmm. So they put the body in a gurney. She puts a phone with a Spotify, bears your social media. You know, the first family picks Annie's song. They push the gurney out in the hallway. The entire hospital staff, busy, by the way, trying to save the lives of people who are still living, now pausing to honor someone who's deceased, holding blue and yellow flameless colors, flameless candles. They push the body, breathtaking scene. They stop 5 feet from the doors. Everyone says goodbye, and the body goes into surgery. She calls it an honor walk, and she has a rule: no photographs. Mm. The next morning, her phone blows up. I want to do an honor walk. How do I solve this problem? What do I do that? The widow posts that picture on Facebook. It gets 2 million likes. There are now 50 donor support groups in America, dozens around the world. They all do honor walks. They've gotten 250 million views on YouTube. There's a classic Hall of Fame new ritual, a problem nobody thought to solve, a problem that's new. So there's no organized religion way of addressing it. Mm-hmm. And clearly is a powerful story that brings people together in a moment that nobody had occasion to think need to be honored before.
Yeah, no, that is a powerful story. The so the no photo rule did not become an immutable part of the ritual. That's a case by case call.
well, that was going to be her thing, but she made an exception. And at that point, no, so many of them are filmed now. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you know, again, here we go. This is the internet. Once it's out there, everybody can do it, you know, can do it their own way. Like, because this is a classic thing that happens here, right? Which is the top-down, pre-scripted, hierarchical, patriarchal rituals that everybody grew up with, you know, those are... They may be, you know, meaning free, the deaths and the mastectomies and the stillbirths, but they were easier. DIY can be deeper, but it's a lot harder. But yet, once people get it, they're going to start iterating it, and that's there we go. There's the internet in it in a nutshell.
So now, in pretty much any hospital, you know, at least in the ICU kind of realm, nurses and doctors would know what the term means. It's that universal.
Yeah. It was on the. I mean, that was a small town in Ohio. I'm from Savannah, Georgia, as you know. That was the lead story in the Savannah paper about 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. You know, one confession I should make, and maybe we'll explore this later. I come from a very low ritual cultural background, which I can elaborate on later. And also, I'm just kind of dispositionally averse to ritual. Yes. And I was thinking, like, if that was me, my first thought was, if somebody asked me to participate in an honor walk, I think I'd be like, isn't this a little hokey? But then I thought, you know, if a relative of mine had died,
yes,
that would be a different story. I think even I would go, yes, I welcome this and participate in it with a straight face, which is saying something for me, I got to say. But there's
context here, Bob. I mean, you know, what I would ask you, and part of the context here is the rivalry, you know, and the Protestant Reformation between the Protestant churches and the Vatican.
Absolutely.
Because the Vatican essentially took over, like, you know, cultures, to speak in terms that I should not dare use in your presence. But you don't mind. But you don't mind spanking me when I'm right. So you'll definitely spank me when I'm wrong. But evolutionarily, the way that the Catholic Church took over something that was 300,000 years old and overtook it and added all of its things. Five of the sacraments are based on, around life rituals. And if I asked anybody, even someone who was a devout atheist, to close your eyes and imagine a funeral, or to imagine a wedding. Like, or to imagine a welcoming ceremony for a baby, what would come to your mind owes 90% of its structure to the Catholic Church for anybody who grew up in the West. Okay, so it was an astonishing thing, but they went too far because then they created the indulgences as workarounds for the rituals. And so, you know, one of the 95 theses, you know, that Luther tacked on that church door was, we're going to downplay the rituals. And so it enters Protestantism as a fundamental difference, a downplaying of ritual compared to the Catholic Church. Even though the Protestant Church ultimately, when we get to Henry VIII, has the greatest ritual liturgy of all time. We gather together, put together, no one put asunder. All of those things were written in the Book of Common Prayer. And so that is the most famous ritual script ever because it was through the Catholic Church and then through, you know, Hollywood to every corner of the planet. And so some of it might be, some Protestant churches embrace it, but some sort of, let's just say, you know, kind of closer to the ground Catholic churches, perhaps similar to how you grew up, still maintain some of their skepticism to ritual.
Yeah. Now, Protestant churches, they vary in their degree of use of ritual. I assume like Episcopalians are at the higher ritual end. We were Southern Baptists. And I specifically remember one of the anti-Catholic talking points I heard was, for us, it's about belief. For them, it's just about ritual.
Yes, right.
And we were low ritual, and I don't think it was just that we were Southern Baptists. My parents were both from West Texas farm families, and I think that kind of fed into it. So, you know, there's no coming of age ritual, per se. Now, baptism in the Baptist church, you're not baptized at birth. You're baptized when you decide that you are ready to accept Christ.
Correct.
For me, I was maybe 10, and so I got baptized. That's a ritual, but it's not a routinized coming of age ritual. For some people, it might happen a little early. For some, a lot later. An example not related to religion was that, like, my family, I never saw a toast. I remember when my brother was married, finally, wow. I witnessed, I was like maybe
That's
16 or 17, and my brother, I was best man. And my brother comes up to me and says, you know, traditionally, like, the best man gives a toast. You probably don't want to do that, right? And I'm like, you read my fucking mind.
Really?
You know? Oh, totally. He said, I can get somebody else to do it. I said, absolutely. You got the green light on that.
Now you're a podcast host, and you were afraid to give a toast to your brother's wedding. Wow.
Yeah, it's hard to describe. Now, we prayed before dinner. That's a ritual.
Yeah. Yes.
And we would proudly say, look, that's a ritual of belief. You're actually communicating with God, okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't mean my family would say that. I don't really remember my family dissing Catholics particularly, although I remember it was like, you know, stretching the envelope of propriety when my sister married a Catholic in those days, you know. there weren't that many, you know, you would do funerals, you would do weddings, but toasts and just formal, like, tributes. And I just don't recall my father ever, like, gathering the family to say anything in a formal way. I don't know. And I, to this day, you know, I'm a tough sell on a ritual, I got to say, as you can gather.
Well, here's what I want to say. So, you know, I've said there are these different kinds of rituals. I've said that there are these five kind of universal rituals that we all go through in our own kind of bespoke fingerprint of needs in the course of our lives. Well, let's get to the essence of what they do. Okay. Mm-hmm. So rituals connect us. They connect the group. Okay. They chronicle the group. Okay. If I said to you, think of the 10 high points and low points of your life, I'm willing to guess that at least half of them would involve rituals of some kind. A marriage, a graduation, a childbirth. A lot of the sort of the backbones, the infrastructure of our life stories tend to revolve around these kinds of occasions. Okay. They sort of sanctify the group. They celebrate the group. But here's the other thing that they do, which shocked me, but which now just makes so much sense that I was sort of able to kind of piece it together. They correct imbalances within the group. And that's what I'm hearing in the story of your brother, right? He comes to you and says, oh, there's some tension here. Who's going to speak? Who's not going to speak? Should it be you? Like, and the ritual kind of fixes that. When my dad died in 2021, not of COVID, as you know, that story was a big, complicated, my dad was never depressed a minute in his life. He would stop strangers in Savannah and give them guides. Strangers would come up to him in airports and say, you look like a nice person, let's talk. Mm-hmm. He was never depressed a minute in his life until he got Parkinson's, got very depressed, depleted serotonin, tried to take his own life 6 times in 12 weeks. I began this process of my sending him questions about his life so that he finished 8 years later, a 65,000 word memoir. He did one question, 1 week at a time. Mm. And when he died, not of COVID, but during COVID, and we all go to Savannah to have this funeral. And my job is, it won't surprise you, was to sort of be the interface between the family and the rabbi, the third oldest synagogue in the country, about how we're going to do this. And my mom says, I don't like that Jewish custom of throwing dirt on the coffin. Mm. It's too barbaric. I want to do long stem yellow roses. Parenthetically, the most Christian idea imaginable, right? So then my sister says that I can't stand the roses. That's too Hallmark. And the dirt's the most important part of this to me. And to my surprise, like the voices escalate. We have this awkward moment. And I say, Rabbi, I think we're going to have a conversation or I'll call you back. At which point I proceed then to kind of middle child my way into a compromise. And I'm like, she lived with the guy for 60 plus years, right? She took care of him the last 10 years when he was, you know, largely incapacitated physically, though not mentally. Like, she once wrote that letter, Heaven Roses, you know? But if you want the dirt, he loved nothing more than Tybee Island. He was like the mayor of the beach. He would talk to everybody. So what did we do at the funeral? We had 3 dozen long stem yellow roses. And we had little plastic bags of Tybee Island sand, and we gave everybody a choice. And what I, in retrospect, learned about this when I was starting to think about ritual was the ritual, in effect, created the conflict. And yet, and then the ritual also resolved the conflict at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then 3-4 years later, when I was went to 10 funerals in a week in Ireland, and I went to one of an old elderly woman, and she was, you know, in Ireland, they put everybody in the same grave. So they can't have steel coffins or steel caskets because the body has to deteriorate more quickly. And they were lowering this woman into the grave of her, the only person she ever danced with and loved. And they took long stem yellow roses and threw it in the open grave. And I was like, there's an example of how some of these things are just universal in ways it's impossible to understand.
Yeah. I want to talk more. I mean, we're about to undergo a transition of our own, and I'm about to engage in the ritual that accompanies it, which is moving into what we call overtime.
Victor, you're using it without air quotes and without irony.
Yeah, no, like, I'm warming up to your whole worldview. Just tell me what rituals I have to perform to join your tribe because I'm sold. we're nearing the end of the public part of the podcast. We're going to go into overtime, available to paid subscribers of Non-Zero newsletters, the link in the show notes. So you can go to nonzero.org and find this post, which will make it easy to become a paid subscriber and thereafter have, if you want, just your own special podcast feeds. It'll always give you access to the complete podcast. Before we go, though, I want to mention again that people should get this book, A Time to Gather, How Ritual Created the World and How It Can Save Us. It really is timely. Bruce, I have my own special AI take on why it's so timely, but I've been thinking about the many ways AI can divide us. There are so many things it used to be like, oh, I need to know this. Who do I know who would know this? And no, you don't go to another person to ask now. It's just like, I noticed, you know, I've said this before, I know, on this podcast, but I always got such a thrill out of giving people directions if they ask, but thanks to Google Maps, nobody asks you for directions, right? That's another point of human contact lost. Correct. And
1 billion points of contact every year. That's 3 million a day. I did the math that we're missing by not embracing these opportunities. So yeah, look, here's what I'll say. This will be, and we can continue the AI conversation after we go behind the paywall. But what I want to say while we're doing this publicly is that when you look at the 300,000-year history of this kind of human behavior, what becomes very, very clear is that in moments of society and in some cases global-wide cultural change, that's when ritual has done its greatest leap, okay? So that's what happened in the Axial Age, okay? When, you know, which thinking about thinking, right? When you had all those religions popped up in a 500-year period in the late first millennium BCE, and you see it most acutely and arrestingly, frankly, in the 19th century with the rise of the Industrial Revolution. And here we can credit the Protestants. It was Queen Victoria, when she married her cousin, who invents the white wedding dress, right? Invents the wedding cake, was the first person to be filmed, one of the first people to have a widely distributed wedding photograph. Later, her funeral was one of the first ones ever put on video. The horses bolted, and they turned the accident of the horses bolted. Now the horses bolt, and they just did it with Queen Elizabeth II. The wedding shower, the registry, all of these things were invented in a very short period of time. Because what happens during that period, as I don't have to tell you, is that 25 million Americans, you know, leave rural areas and move to cities, and 25 mm-hmm. million more people emigrate from Europe and come over, and they flood into cities, and a whole series of rituals pop up at that time in response to this change. So here we are now, surely the most analogized time to what's coming with AI is the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. And I believe that what we're seeing is something that is under discussed. And I look forward to discussing with you, in this, after we go behind the paywall and in any other forum, what is in a world in which almost everything about AI is over discussed, the thing that is most under discussed is it will have a human reaction. And what we are seeing now in this ritual renaissance is a reaction to the dislocation, the digital saturation, and all the other things that are happening, the polarization, the loneliness, all of these kinds of things. There is going to be a human reaction that we are discounting. And what's going on in ritual, I think, is the canary in the coal mine of what's actually going to come as we stand up and say, we're not just going to give up. And my way of saying this, last page of my book, right? It's virtual or ritual. Right? It's URL or IRL. And I think IRL is going to have more power pushing back on URL than people think right now.
Yeah. No, that's a great juxtaposition of letters. And I want to pursue that in overtime. So thanks everybody who's followed us this far. Hope you'll follow us into overtime. There's a lot of things I want to discuss. If you're not going to follow us into overtime, you should spend your time ordering Bruce's book, A Time Together.